Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 189.2P0312, certificate number 54094, the Carrington event.
You know, for the first time in my life, a couple weeks ago, after just decades of waiting, I finally got to see the Northern Lights.
Hey, congratulations. You're a member of the North Pole Club.
Is there a club?
No, but I know it is like on the list, on a lot of people's list of things they need to do before they die.
Well, I can see why. You know, like in pictures, it just looks eye-popping. It's a natural... Imagine if you hadn't seen like lightning or snow your whole life,
right,
you know?
Right.
And yet it's one that you kind of have to chase because you have to go to someplace inhospitable during the worst time to go there.
Well, now, wait a minute. Speaking of, for all of the people who live in northern climes, it's not inhospitable. Well, I guess it is.
Well, the problem is the times you would want to go to Sitka or Reykjavik,
right?
You can't go because it's
cold. I mean, you can. They have tickets still.
What I'm saying is during the season you'd like to be there, you're not likely to see the Northern Lights because it's going to be bright most or all of the night.
Oh, I see. You're saying the time you want to be in Reykjavik is in the summer.
If there is such a thing. Last time I was there was summer and it still kind of sucked.
I
want to say hi to all our Icelandic listeners.
I think in the winter is when you go and you see you go to the hot springs and you see in Alaska, you see the hoarfrost.
See hoarfrost?
Yeah. You go to the Miner and Trapper Ball. That's all the times. We have all the winter times.
I think you're just making things up now. And that would be very funny if you were like, there's the reindeer cotillion. There's we go ice sludging.
Yeah, we go ice sludging. When I was a kid in Anchorage, they had actual auto races through the town where they built giant snow embankments like up against buildings, mm-hmm. and then drove like European sports cars like 70s Porsches and stuff, but the tires had nails in them.
What?
Yeah. They would do these incredibly like hairball races.
It is the Monte Carlo of the North, I'm always saying.
Yeah, that's right. But sled dogging, you know, that's all happening up there.
In the winter?
That's right.
Okay.
That's when it works best.
I guess
otherwise you'd have to have it'd be wheels.
It'd be like marsh sledding.
Yeah, marsh sledding. No, it's a winter event.
It's just, you know, we're in a high point of solar activity right now. And so there have been, in the last few years, there have been multiple, like, hey, Seattle, you might be able to see the aurora tonight.
Yeah.
And I've been out of town, or it was cloudy. Yeah. Do you know people who, like, I know people who have been, like, driving to Cleellum, hoping to get out from under the clouds.
We did. We drove over to, I mean, not out from under the clouds, but we drove over to Covington or whatever, and just it was
get
a bust.
Just to get away from the city light.
Yeah, but then the prison in Monroe has quadrupled the amount of arc lights it's pointing at itself, and it looked like a UFO landing right over the horizon.
Every time somebody escapes and kills a gas station attendant, they buy another searchlight.
That's right. So, but that was a night, that was the night after one of the big Northern Lights events, and there were none. So we just sat out there, and it was just my daughter and me, and we parked in a cornfield and sat there staring at the night sky until we were both like, oh, well.
But you'd seen it before.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, 100 times.
But does that mean you're just bored of it? It's like, to you, it's like seeing the moon or something?
I wanted to show it to her because she hasn't seen it.
But you're not like...
Because she didn't grow up in Alaska.
Because to me, it's like the most tantalizing thing, space weather,
yeah,
that you can see, and it looks like the best screensaver
I mean,
you
I've, can imagine. I've seen it a lot, but also seen it, you know, with the backdrop of Mount McKinley and in those...
We say Denali now.
Oh, that's right. Well, the park is Denali. Did we change the name of the mountain too?
Somebody in Ohio died, and they finally changed the name of the mountain. Whoever was always filibustering that died.
I'm not up on all of it, but I know the Barrow's not called Barrow anymore.
Wait, is that true?
Yeah,
Barrow's got an indigenous name.
It does. Yeah, it's called Utqiagvik now.
Wow,
which is Inupiaq.
I mean, that's great if you're Inupiaq, but I mean, if you're the city of Utqiagvik trying to hope people will remember your name, it's, for white people, it's going to be a little tough.
Yeah, I think that they aren't worried about people remembering their name. I think that it's definitely like part of the fun.
Like if you have to go there for some oil reason, you're still going to have to go there?
Well, and I wonder whether the people who don't want to learn it are just going to call it Barrow. It's just going to be one of those things. Like
saying Reagan or National for the airport.
some of me, like, I guess knowing that McKinley is no longer McKinley, but also just being so old that it's like, oh, that's the park is Denali.
You do have to remember that when old people say something old timey and dumb, I now realize this as a new old.
Yeah.
We are actually not trying to be fuddy-duddies.
Yeah, that's right.
We're just saying the thing that we said.
We were downtown the other night, me and two other rock musicians, all of us still very young. The other two guys still dye their hair. And we're like, oh, yeah, we should go to that cafe. What's the one up by the – it's over next to the – and I thought it was me. And then the other two are like, well, no, it's right across from the and then somebody else was like, I don't think that one's there anymore. Well, what about the one? No, I don't think that's there. And all three of us, just regular people, Ken, we're just regular young rock dudes.
Just ordinary men.
We could not get the names of any of these places that we'd all been to 100 times.
Even a place on the same block to use as a reference point.
What was the name of the cafe across from Machiavelli on Pine and Bellevue or Belmont?
It's a good Jeopardy clue.
Yeah, I know, exactly. So anyway, we couldn't, but yeah, so when I say it, I'm not trying to be curmudgeonly. I just honestly, my mind is...
You're not like Mount McKinley, like somebody
not like
who,
you woke mountain like, yeah, renamers.
What is the example of people? There is some example of people who will drop the old name on purpose, but I can't remember what's the...
Oh, it's like the Redskins, right? Or the...
I'm not saying Cleveland Guardians. Screw you guys.
But no, I think that like my sense of Utqiagvik is that the high school is still called Barrow High.
Mm.
So it's just, I mean, of course there are going to be people up there who are Inupiaq who also.
Yeah, for them it's going to be easier to say that than Barrow, no?
Well, I think that there are probably old curmudgeons up there who are like, no, it's Barrow. Come on, it's been Barrow my whole life.
Well,
anyway,
my take on the aurora is it was pretty good.
And when it's good, It is very, very good. And when it is bad, it is horrid. But when it's great, I mean, it's one of the greatest things you'll ever see.
People today, I think, we just happened to be in the San Juans, and I had kind of strolled. They had said there was a chance between, you know, like when the moon goes down, it'll be really, you know, best odds like 11 to 1 or 11 to 2.
Right.
And I walked out at, I don't know, 10 o'clock, and there was nothing doing. And then like 10 minutes later, I walk out again, kind of brushing my teeth in the cold. And like, there's things in the sky I cannot explain, you know, like I'm seeing a UFO encounter.
I mean, one of the things about seeing a true moment is you really get the sense that's 500 miles high. Mm. Like it is doing its thing, but it's not like the sky.
It's higher than any part of the sky you've seen anything in.
Yeah, right. It's not clouds. It's not
like a thunderhead or
it's not anything. It's unfathomably.
And it was very big. It was going pretty much from the horizon to the zenith. So
you saw a great one.
And I'm like, with my mouth full of toothpaste suds, I'm like, Randy, Randy.
Did you get reds and purples?
So, like, you know, the age of the cell phone has trained everyone to think that you missed a great aurora.
Yeah.
And in fact, just cell phones have night mode and are really good at long exposures and color correcting. So
they can make nothing look like a real thing.
Yeah, like you looked in the sky and you saw kind of a vague shifting, and then the cell phones are, you know, three color, rainbow sherbet kind of a sky. In this case, it was good enough that you could definitely see, you know, waves and spires of green, towers of green kind of moving over you. And then you could see that there were areas where the green was a little warmer, that it was a purplish pink. But it wasn't like, and it was kind of with averted vision or in comparison to the other color, you had a sense that it was multicolored.
Yeah.
The greens were more vivid. It's, I did not understand this at the time, but I mean, I knew in a vague sense that the solar wind was sending us charged particles, electrons or protons. The Earth's magnetic field would kind of suck those up, and that's strongest at the poles, which is why you get auroras in the north and the south, and less in the equatorial regions. But one thing I did not understand is the different colors come from them interacting with different components of the atmosphere.
Oh.
So when it hits oxygen, when it hits O2, you know, that's the wavelength that results. You know, it's you hit a gas with energy in the lab at the right the right wavelength, you can make it glow. So it's the same deal here. Oxygen looks green. There's also N2, nitrogen gas, in the atmosphere, and that's what the pinks and the blues and the purples are. The really deep reds are also oxygen, but it's from much higher up.
Oh.
So up there, the oxygen is so diffused that it's reacting at a different wavelength.
Oh.
When the charge hits it.
The ones.
And that's when you see the dark red.
Yeah, if you see an aurora with reds and oranges, and then especially the if you see like a real blue.
Yeah.
Like not a green blue, but like a blue. They seem to be extra dimensional, right? Because the green ones can kind of be in the sky.
It's a ghost. Yeah.
But then those other colors, they seem higher up and...
And it's because they are, it turns out.
Yeah. And then the greens and purples and stuff are still in those too.
It's shimmering in front of it like a diaphanous thing. Yeah, it really has made me consider becoming an aurora chaser, even though that means risking a lot of bummer trips to sit in socked in northern Iceland.
Or just the bummer of going up there for a week and it just doesn't happen.
Right, exactly.
Which also, I think people do all the time where they're like, we're going to see it. And then it turns out, oh, in Norway, if you'd been there.
But these solar phenomena happen in cycles and we're kind of at a high point now. And maybe decades will go by before there's another window like this.
I don't want to sound like I ever was blasé about them. But there was a...
Here's you doing an aurora. This again.
There were a couple of years in the 80s where they were really flaming in Alaska. And I remember one time I called my mom and sister out from the house. And we were just standing in the street in front of our house. Street lights on, you know, and the sky was just electrified. But it was also 20 below zero.
Yeah.
And we were standing out there and, you know... Because you're not moving, right, there's just no amount of extra coat you can put on. and everybody's getting chilled to the bone. And eventually both my mom and sister are like, okay, you know, they Griswolded it. And we're like, okay, good night. And I'm out there all by myself shivering in the street like, no, it's the greatest.
Well, even in Puget Sound in October, where, you know, where I'm sure it was probably, you know, 48 degrees that night, right. We're out on the deck and I'm like kind of lying on my back looking upward and I'm like, I don't think this is worth it. Why can't this happen at the beach? But, you know, I'm definitely at a point in my life where I am going to be easily moved by flowery and poetic descriptions of aurorae, and that's what I spent this morning reading, a 2005 NASA paper collecting eyewitness reports from late August and early September of 1859.
Oh, back when people wrote poetry just in their normal letters.
Like, and just like in the New York Times, you know, like a big solar storm meant front page news all the way across America, you know, like curtains of light in the sky, says the Columbia plane registrar, you know, there's just hundreds of these. And some NASA researchers collected them in 2005. And a lot of it came from the collection, the mid-19th century collection of one Joseph Henry. He had started up he was the head of the Smithsonian.
Oh.
And this is so good, it's going to be its own omnibus, I think, so I won't spoil much of it. But he basically invented modern weather forecasting.
Right on.
It had
my second favorite dull dad thing to do.
Let's talk about the weather. Well, this is actually going to be a more interesting weather conversation than you would imagine.
Because
as late as that, nobody had ever thought, hey, what if you could like predict the weather by finding out what it did east of here yesterday?
Oh.
This was a new idea.
Oh, because the telegraph allowed you to know that.
For the first time, you didn't have to wait for a letter from your cousin saying, it was quite a rainy summer in Boston. Whereas now, for the first time, you could be like, hey, it rained yesterday in Boston. It might rain tomorrow in
Newfoundland.
Utica. Or, yeah. It actually typically goes east to west. And I think weather tends to go east from east to west across the eastern United States.
Does it?
Apparently. Am I getting this backwards?
East to west? What the hell is that weather doing?
Oh, no, I think you're right. I think actually his light bulb moment was weather tends to move west to east.
Oh.
And so he would get all these... He basically crowdsourced.
Wait, nobody noticed that before. That the weather was coming from. I mean,
you could stand and watch it move in, like, yeah. Richard Dreyfuss.
As a nerd, a weather nerd, like every time the wind changes direction here, I'm like, I've got my wet finger up in the air, like, oh.
But we're awash in data.
That's true.
You know, farmers were more interested in climate than weather because, you know, they at the beginning of the year they'd have an almanac tell them it's going to be a dry summer.
Right.
The almanac would speak in an outrageous New England accent for some reason.
Hail! Can't get far from here.
Hailstone the size of a bullfrog in September.
Your car's on fire.
But now that there's the telegraph, you can actually start to plot this on a map. So he had hundreds of people, the equivalent of today's weather crowdsourcing apps, sending him like, hey, it's clear in Buffalo. It's clear and cold in Buffalo. And they put a big a national weather map up on the Washington Mall.
What?
On the national. And it was like a tourist attraction because it was the first weather map. Like imagine,
right.
You know, today it's behind every guy in the 6 o'clock news, but he just invented it and put it on in front of the Smithsonian.
That's fantastic. The ultimate dull men's club. He should be the poster boy for the whole operation.
He invented dull men. I guess maybe the inventor of the train had already invented dull men.
Yeah, I suppose.
I don't know. So anyway, he already had these informants all across the nation sending him barometric pressures. And so when there was solar weather, he was the guy that immediately got all the juice.
And did they know then what it was?
They did not. They knew that it had been seen for centuries. This was a ginormous solar storm that started on August 28th, and then there was a later burst a few days later on September 2nd.
At what year?
1859. Visible as far south as Honolulu. So the entire United States, not just the continental U.S., Cuba was seeing the northern lights.
Whoa.
And this was a remarkable one. You know, people knew that lots of the places in Europe where the auroras are seen most frequently, you know, gave us our culture. You know, it's the Scots and the Vikings. These are the people that knew about the auroras.
Right.
So I guess a lot of the headlines at the time, it was very common to refer to the aurora by its colloquial Shetland Islands name, Merry Dancers.
Merry Dancers.
So you would say the Merry Dancers were seen again over Lake Michigan. And then you would say, today the scientists wish us to use the Latin name of aurorae. But, you know, but it was more common to use the folksy name that Grandpa would have said. And this was quite the storm. Not, you know, this put my Lopez Island experience to shame. It was bright enough to read a newspaper by.
Whoa.
I don't know if you've ever had that experience in the shadow of Mount McKinley, Denali.
I guess not.
In a lot of the accounts, there must have been enough crimson that some of the accounts, most of them, most of the people are just in awe at the beauty. Like here's one newspaper. This is... Now vivid arrows of light of most exceeding brilliancy shot up from the whole northern horizon and retreating would again shoot higher and higher until they covered the whole sky. This continued to grow darker, first to scarlet, then to crimson, and finally to the blood-red appearance of an immense conflagration. The whole sky appeared mottled red, the arrows of fire shooting up from the north like a terrible bombardment of which we could see all and hear none. So we think of it as an ethereal fairy lights kind of a thing, but it was so red in this case that a lot of people thought of it as a hellish vision.
Whoa.
In Rochester, New York, apparently the red clung to the horizon to the degree that they assumed that surrounding towns were on fire and that they were actually seeing flames before they realized it was a phenomenon.
Yeah, it seems like that telegraph would help in that respect. Are you on fire? I mean, I've seen it a couple of times in life while the sun was in the sky.
Oh, really?
So bright that it was visible in twilight, or, you know, at the end of the day.
But more of the, this is the San Francisco Herald, much more like this. The whole sky appeared to undulate something like a field of grain in a high wind. Mm-hmm. Beautiful beyond description, wrote the Washington Daily National Intelligencer. And a friend nearby us, while looking to the zenith with the whole heavens and earth lighted up at a greater brilliancy than is afforded by the full moon, said that it was like resting beneath the wings of the Almighty. So some people are using religious, you know, angelic language
right.
to describe it. It was a time when even the New York Times would say, the northern heavens were perfectly illuminated with the exception of a few dim and almost imperceptible white streamers which passed from the zenith nearly halfway down to the North Star. Streamers of yellow and orange shot up and met and crossed each other like the bayonets upon a stack of guns in the open space between the constellations. You know, these reporters are just getting carried away by what they're seeing.
Right.
And again, you know, in places where it turned red, the San Francisco Herald says the appearance now is positively awful.
Oh.
Because it's both heavenly and apocalyptic at the same time. But, you know, this is just leading the news all over the country. And there are kind of, there's funny local color in a lot of the stories is what I find from this NASA collection. In the Rockies, some miners woke up and started making breakfast, believing that they were seeing the dawn.
Oh, it's the old eclipse. The birds all go to sleep.
Well, that happened too. In New Orleans, there was a report that the larks, the earliest bird apparently, had all started to sing, thinking that the dawn was coming. And then, that's so sweet. And then the Picayune also reports, and then an unprecedented event. A hunter was able to bag three larks at 1 a.m. Like, locals just started shooting the confused birds.
Good job.
Just so they could say, you know, for the first time, I went bird hunting in the middle of the night, and I bagged three larks.
But at this point, scientists had isolated some of the gases, right, and excited them electrically?
So there is speculation. Oh, one. This is another funny postscript in New Orleans. It is an indisputable fact that old topers, wholesale consumers of the alcoholic fluid, you know who I'm talking
about. Sure, the alcoholic fluid, as we say.
Whose capacious stomachs could retain an enormous quantity of the creature without their heads or legs being in the least affected by it. So, like, you know, the drunkiest of the drunks of Bourbon Street have fallen dead drunk last night and last Sunday night before they had imbibed their regular allowance.
Oh.
And through no other cause than the mysterious influence upon their system of the unexplained electrical phenomenon shining overhead.
Oh, it's saying that they were getting schnookered by the...
You could get a little wasted on just the sky. It was so good.
Drunk on the sky.
This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free select DeWalt, Craftsman, or Kobalt tool with purchase of a select battery kit. Plus, get a free Werner 2-foot aluminum ladder when you buy an 8-foot fiberglass ladder. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
So, you know, you could see there that there's, you know, we know about electricity at this point in history. So that kind of phenomenon is making people think it must be electrical. The Boston Transcript says, we know of no known causes that would produce such celerity of motion as these merry dancers seem to have, unless it be galvanism. In other words, it's moving too fast to be anything but electricity.
Oh, I see.
But it's still all this speculation. Like, boy, this sure has the vibes of science.
Uh huh.
But we can't really tell you what it is.
Science vibes.
It really affected the culture. There's still a Frederick Church painting called Aurora Borealis, one of his great nature landscapes that he painted that night.
And does it look like, because in Alaska, a painting of the aurora on a gold pan.
Is this a common
cache like a food cache on stilts is a kind of somewhat ubiquitous object of kitsch art,
right,
that hangs in a lot of places, offices and people's homes.
In a gold pan.
A gold pan. So, you know, a larger size gold pan, which is what am I? I'm holding my hands 18 inches
in
diameter.
You're acting like I know the size of gold pans like a pizza.
Like, yeah, it's like an extra large pizza, but it's a gold pan. And then people paint scenes in them. And I think by far the most popular scene to paint is the Northern Lights.
Does it capture the aurora at all, or is it?
I mean, you know what it is.
Here's the Frederick Church painting. I think it's Labrador. He's up north somewhere.
No, that is a much more elaborate depiction of the Northern Lights than you can put into a gold pan.
Does this to you seem like they've really captured it, or is it like this guy's kind of embellishing picking the highlights?
I didn't see this incredible display, so that seems like really, really good.
Like this one has like lines, you know, it's like the curtains are so delineated that they look like the bottom of your drapes have, you know, have a thick tasseled border.
It's the whole horizon to horizon, which it usually isn't, you know, usually it's somewhat located in the sky in a band, at least
in the north, I would expect
in the north.
I thought when I stepped out on my deck, I'm like, oh, you know what? If this is in the north sky, us being in the Pacific Northwest, it's going to be behind those Douglas firs and cedars and Western hemlocks. We will never see any of this. And when it started to spread up to the top of the celestial dome, I was in shock. Speaking of shock, a report from Columbus, Ohio said a young girl had become so distraught at the sight of the aurora that she was taken to the asylum. You know, the implication is that you can lose your mind from if you're kind of on the brink anyway and something unexpected appears in the sky.
Hmm, I guess.
And that's, you know, and that's a lot of the responses are, you know, there are scientists saying, what is this thing? Because the aurora has not yet been explained. It all gets a little more confusing at the same time if you work in the nascent telegraph industry, which, as we have just mentioned, was no more than 15 years old. Even though it's only been 15 years since the birth of the telegraph, there are over 100,000 miles of telegraph wires now. I think.
Whoa. Is that fast?
Is that worldwide or in the U.S.?
It must be worldwide. 100,000.
But can you imagine
miles
in 15 years to get 100,000 miles of line?
Should have invested in the cable stocks.
I mean, that is the equivalent of why didn't I buy Apple,
right,
in time, right, or some internet stock. And the storm, as you might expect, does have an effect on the only thing that there is like a power grid in 1859, which an electrical power grid, which is the telegraph wires. Individual telegraph machines at stations begin to spark, and communication is shut down as far south as Washington, D.C. Suddenly, as the lights in the sky intensify, this is a very fun kind of mystical take on it. Fantastic and unreadable messages begin to arrive in Philadelphia, you know, as if from as if from the very gates of hell, you know, like an oracle is speaking. And then the lines shut down altogether.
It never occurred to me that it would affect radios and stuff, but I guess it probably did.
Yeah, like as we'll see, as man's technological footprint increases and electrical footprint increases, these kind of storms become more and more disruptive. But at the time, there had never been anything to test this on, you know, like there had been no telegraph lines or anything like it, no power lines. So when the storm starts up again on September 2nd, a few days later, the same things happen. The communication goes out. A few machines start to spark. But something strange happens here. An operator in Boston accidentally discovers that by completely disconnecting the battery, maybe he's trying to turn it off and back on, suddenly the telegraph works without power.
Whoa.
He can reach Portland, Maine without being plugged in.
Whoa.
The same thing happens between New York and Pittsburgh. Some operator in New York City realizes that the telegraph is only working if you turn it off. Like now it's a Ouija board, basically. And they realize something, you know, today we would say it's the auroral currents in the atmosphere carrying the message in the way that the wires would. They just knew that, who knows, the Earth itself has become a lodestone of telegraphy. They have no idea what's going on. One operator in D.C. by the name of Frederick Royce finds that he can no longer raise Richmond, to whom he was in the middle of, I think he was receiving, he's working the receiver, he's receiving a message from further south. And suddenly the receiver, the register he's using, which is what they call the receiver, it's powered by some kind of electromagnet. And suddenly that electromagnet has gone to ground and it cannot be lifted. It's so heavy. And so while he's holding that, he accidentally makes the mistake of brushing his forehead against, you know, something on the wall that also has wires running down it. And suddenly somebody watching him reports that they see a spark of fire jump from his forehead down to his hand on the register.
And he becomes the Batman.
And he had superpowers. He becomes Captain Borealis. No, he gets the worst shock of his life and gets thrown to the ground.
Oh,
and,
but he doesn't become become dead.
He does not become dead. He survives this, becomes neither a superhero nor dead.
Whoa.
And so people are speculating about what the cause must be of these things, you know, because now that they know that it's interrupting, all the headlines are about to say, now it's also interrupting telegraphy. Clearly, it's the nature of the aurora has long been speculated on. Now we know it's electrical. The Melbourne Argus, because this is happening in the southern hemisphere all the way up to Chile.
Oh, it is.
Notes that it all was presaged by a falling star. A meteor was seen in the sky, and then the aurora happened. And I guess this was a common theory at the time.
That it was some kind of, the meteor had disturbed the atmosphere.
The meteor causes, that the meteor showers and falling stars are caused by what they called nebulous matter. Some kind of space gunk was falling into the atmosphere, or the Earth was passing through it, and this was creating the nebula. The San Francisco Herald speculated that it must be the zodiacal light that fills all space.
Zodiacal?
They're just making stuff up now. I mean, the idea that space was full of some kind of fluid that carried impulses.
Zodiacum.
It's what carries your zodiacum. Uh-huh. I don't want you to ever say that word again, actually. I'm no longer into zodiacum. The New York Herald reports kind of matter-of-factly that, as we all know, nothing in the past or present will affect the aurora. So it can't be the peace in Via Franca, like it mentions events of the day. The aurora can't have anything to do with that. As we all know, omens in the sky refer to the future. So who knows what volcanic eruption or earthquake, or has long been supposed, icebergs are being predicted by this. And I was like, icebergs?
Icebergs.
Apparently the most common idea was that the aurora predicted iceberg activity.
I mean, I guess at the time, icebergs were a major concern. This is kind of like, why are you looking for your watch, your lost watch under the streetlight? Because the light is good there.
Today we think a lot less about icebergs.
Yeah, it doesn't come up as much.
But also, yeah, it does seem to be the thing like, well, they both happen up north, icebergs and the aurora. So what's the connection? Riddle me that, scientists.
Right, and there has to be, it has to be useful in some way. It can't just be like we know it to be now.
Completely unrelated.
Just like, whatever.
They're both side effects of something else. But that's a very unsatisfying answer. But an answer does come. It didn't happen during the first storm on August 28th, but on September 1st, shortly before the second wave of aurora hits the darkened parts of both hemispheres, a British astronomer named Richard Carrington happens to be outside looking at the sun.
Yeah, sure.
Because he's an idiot.
Yeah, that's how I imagine British astronomers.
Two kinds of British men. Two kinds of British men are looking at the sun: the smartest and the dumbest.
Uh-huh.
And this guy is actually one of the smartest. He is sketching sunspots.
How is he doing it?
Oh, he must have some kind of a
dark glass
lens or something. Yeah, he's got welder's tinted glass, some kind of glass that helps him do it. And he's sketching sunspots because, you know, at the time it was, you know, sunspots had been seen very early. It was quickly discovered there was some kind of pattern or cycle. What could they be? And as he's sketching the sunspots, he sees a huge flash on the surface of the sun.
Oh.
And the next day, the aurora begins.
Oh.
That night, the aurora begins.
He's just the right scientist at the right place at the right time.
And there is, in fact, another guy named a less famous guy, kind of a gentleman scientist, amateur scientist named Hobson, is also observing this. So Carrington and Hobson are the two names that become associated with the coincidence of looking up at the right time, so that we now, for the first time, connect things on the surface of the sun with the aurora. Not a natural connection that any Shetland Islands fisherman had ever made.
Because they weren't looking at the sun.
Well, they
through what you guess have to be scientific instruments in order to have seen a sun
right
flash.
To see a solar flare. I think you couldn't just look up at the right time and be like, "Did you guys see that? Did the sun just blink?" And I guess the fact that auroras come at night means it would not be natural to think, could anything on the sun be causing this?
Right, of course.
Like all these yo-yos who are like, I bet it's icebergs.
Right,
all
it's the moon.
All the dumb Kevins are going to be like, it's the moon. It's icebergs. No, it's the moon. No, it's a meteor. It's always going to be some chilly nocturnal presence.
Yeah, right.
Not the sun. But Richard Carrington and apparently this other guy, Hobson, it's usually now called the Carrington event, I think to observe the scientific proprieties of honor all the discoverers, and obviously Carrington and Hobson would have seen this thing in the exact same millisecond. Sometimes it's hyphenated as the Carrington-Hobson event.
But Hobson, whatever, reported it an hour later?
I think Carrington was just the big name. Like, he was the astronomer who was actually doing the work.
Right.
This other guy was just some yo-yo. This is the first time a solar flare has ever been reported. The surface of the sun is...
Oh, so it wasn't just that he was connecting the solar flare to the aurora, but it was the first solar flare.
I don't think anybody had seen a solar flare
happen.
Ah,
okay.
So the sun, like the Earth, has a magnetic field, but unlike the Earth, its rotation is not, we're crunchy. The Earth's crunchy, and the sun is gooey. So when we rotate, it's in a reliable way. You know, stuff inside the Earth is maybe happening and affecting the magnetic field, and maybe is why we have one, in fact.
Right.
But the magnetic field is pretty predictable. The sun is a big ball of nougat, or plasma, I think is more accurate.
Yeah, I mean, I like plasma for candy bars and nougat for the sun.
You're going to start eating plasma candy bars?
Yeah, and saying like, oh, another nougat explosion.
Do you feel like Star Wars... guns are going to fire nougat now instead of, aren't they plasma blasters?
They are, but I like that a lot better.
So this
nougat.
And because of that, it means, there's a lot more, imagine a lot of, bending and coiling of the magnetic field as it rotates. Energy will build up and spots will be suddenly get a little cool because the magnetic field is not uniform. And that's the sunspots that Carrington and others were looking at. But then sometimes, often at the same time as sunspot activity is high, that means there's
something else.
There's a low point. There's a cold point, and the equilibrium is building up. The rubber band is getting taut, and at some point it's going to spring back, and that's when you get things like solar flares shooting into space. And these things are what disrupt our weather. Solar weather disrupts our own atmospheric well-being.
Does it predict icebergs?
And in fact, does not predict icebergs.
I see.
Or volcanic eruptions or earthquakes, to my knowledge. The sun's very far away. You know, it's almost amazing. I mean, it's so far away that it takes like, what, 8 minutes or something.
It looks like it's right there.
It seems it's so big.
Yeah.
Whatever, 93 million miles. Is that right? I'm just going to guess.
This all sounds like a They Might Be Giants song now.
Yes. The sun is a massive incandescent gas. It's not. That's the first version of their song. Do you know this? They had that science album for kids where they covered an old... I think maybe even before they got into kids' songs, they did a cover of an old educational song. They said the sun is a massive incandescent gas.
Turns out it's not.
Right. When
it's
they
a massive nougat.
When the fourth state of matter, nougat, was discovered, they had to record a new version of the song where they admit that the sun is a miasma of incandescent plasma. They got very lucky.
That's nice.
That there's a word that rhymes with plasma and can...
Sort of rhymes,
and can stand in for... Oh, you'd be above using miasma plasma as a rhyme?
I guess. I mean, that's fine.
Are there long winter songs with feminine rhymes, with two-syllable rhymes like that? Would you ever rhyme cupboard with blubbered?
Yeah. I mean, I used every kind of rhyme, including non-rhyme rhyme.
Including unrhyming things.
I did the Chuck D thing where I did internal rhymes.
Well, approximate rhyme is much more accepted in rap where, you know, if somebody says precinct and she think, actually that's close. That's closer than you would get.
A lot closer.
Yeah, it's like, oh, the vowel is the same. That counts, which would not maybe fly on Broadway, for example. So at the time of the Carrington event, as this strange event in the skies and in telegraph receivers came to be called, the stakes were pretty low. Only telegraph operators noticed it beyond anything but a weird silent omen. And I guess that lady in Columbus, Ohio, that went crazy.
As soon as they got their telegraphs back up and running, didn't they begin to report it widely?
They did. I mean, everybody, it was big news, but I'm just saying it wasn't a big hit to the economy. You know, most messages could be resent shortly thereafter. Some estimates say that it cost, you know, $300,000 in inefficiency because we are effectively the world's power grid got knocked out.
$300,000 twice in a week. $1850s dollars.
I kind of wonder. Yeah, I kind of wonder which they mean. But anyway, small potatoes in a world that was not running on electricity that much. And in the years since then, there have been intervals in which solar weather, space weather, we now call it, which is kind of funny.
Do we call it that? Is that the term?
Yeah.
The term of art, space weather?
Yeah, in fact, the place in Boulder, Colorado that now monitors this is the SWPC, the Space Weather Prediction Center.
This is a level of dull dad I didn't even know existed.
It's, you know, it's formerly the Space Environment Center, and somebody chose space weather either for promotional or accuracy reasons.
Was it someone from Space Force?
No, this all predates Space Force. Oh. But it does make you, maybe is the idea that, you know, people are used to hearing alerts about how weather can affect them. Let's call this weather, and maybe it'll...
Yeah.
It'll help with visibility.
Yeah. I mean, I'm wondering what else you would call it.
We call it the solar wind, even though obviously there's no atmosphere. It's just charged particles heading outward.
I guess that always made sense to me, but wind is weather.
And the stuff that happens like solar flares tends to be directional. You know, it has to come at the Earth for it to affect us. You know, it's not like every time one of those happens on the sun, look out. It doesn't expand like a sphere.
Right.
But in the years since then, every time one of these intervals of solar weather happened, it's gotten worse each time, not because the sun got worse, but because technology advanced. You know, the next time it happened, railroad switching stations were now electrical. And so for the first time, there were transit consequences.
Any trains hit each other?
No, but there were fires at train stations, I guess, because of more electrical equipment available. News wires, you know, news could now go out over... There was now a newswire, so communications could be disrupted beyond telegraphy. Then the teletype machine is invented. And so when these happen, you know, now it's disrupting teletype. Next time it happens, it's disrupting the transatlantic cables. Next time it's the radio. Yeah, next time it's the newswire. So yeah, it's starting to creep into more and more aspects of modern life to the degree that when a solar storm hits in May 1967, it knocks out the radar of the NATO's polar early warning system.
And the Russians attacked in the darkness, and that's why we all speak Russian now.
It could have happened. It was one of these, we discussed this in the mutually assured destruction entry, you know, was that a good idea or not? it worked, but on the other hand, there were plenty of times when the jets scrambled. And this was one of them. Like, nuclear-equipped jets were about to be scrambled because what's happening? What knocked out our system? Is it the Ruskies? You know, you're basically everybody is Slim Pickens or Sterling Hayden in Dr. Strangelove.
And then some young guy runs in holding a sheaf of papers going, stop, stop!
It's the sun! It's the sun! Probably. Like, some other government agency probably did have to tell them, no, 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 this is happening everywhere. It's the sun. Here, let me explain to you what a solar flare is.
But because the Russian radars were all made of wood.
Yeah, they were unaffected. Affected. The Russians brought pencil to space. 5 years later, it actually becomes a little less theoretical. As you may recall, the U.S. had been planting mines outside of North Vietnamese harbors in the early 70s. Possibly in violation of international law. I'm not going to get into that.
You know.
I'm not going to get into that.
What are you going to, both sides mining the North Korean harbors, Ken?
So, and at this point, for whatever reason, the electronics of these mines are susceptible to the atmospheric disturbances of solar weather.
Seems like an oversight.
4,000 of them go off at once.
You're kidding.
No, and this is the kind of thing that could intensify or start a shooting war.
Oh my God. And can you imagine the North Koreans, like
Vietnamese?
Oh, it was North Vietnam. Oh, right, of course. Can you imagine them looking at that and going, what was the strategy here?
Yeah, like,
what? Was that supposed to intimidate us, or
is this shock and awe?
Just killing the fish? I don't get it.
Yeah, there's those mines are not going to get a second use. So these kind of severe space weather events, tend to come and go. And in 2008, they had really not been studied. It was a curiosity. Every time they happened, it was like, oh yeah, this is like that Carrington event where the telegraph operator got shocked. Lol, it's a modern version of that. This time it's affecting cables. But nobody had ever really seriously considered.
Why?
Well, we knew the why, but nobody ever considered what happens next time. Oh. Because all these ones that are causing news-making events appear to be roughly an order of magnitude smaller than the Carrington event had been in 1859. There had just not been a Carrington event in the power grid era.
Right.
But in 2008, that all changed. The National Academy of Sciences released a bulletin called Severe Space Weather Events, just kind of predicting what would happen if there were a Carrington event, not just in the power grid age, in the electrical age, but in the space age.
Right.
It turns out it's not good.
If there were astronauts in the space station, what would happen to them?
Not just that. They would all get superpowers.
Right.
But what about the 8,000 satellites we have orbiting the Earth?
Oh, you know, what about them?
They're all...
I don't care about them.
Oh, you do.
Oh, do I?
They all have GPS.
Right.
Every other system in the world relies on GPS.
Yeah, but not me. I know where I'm going.
You may, without knowing it, because everything in... All these GPS satellites also have atomic clocks. That's what helps them say where they are, because they're slightly, you know, further away from another point. Without atomic clocks, GPS don't work. Basically, all of our timekeeping and place knowing that our world does is now a free service provided by GPS satellites. And because it's a free service, nobody has ever worked out a backup.
Well, I celebrate not knowing what time it is or where I am.
This is going to be a dream come true for you,
then. It's going to be another Christmas.
The FAA is the lone exception. Like, knowing that commercial air travel would be fatal without GPS, they actually have backups in place. Here's how planes would fly if the GPS system went down. But nobody else has one. Everybody else is just assuming the GPS will always work. And that's not just like, well, now the GPS in my car or my phone won't work. Like, it's kind of the, you know, it's split second, you know, centimeter accuracy kind of stuff, like oil drilling and bridge building and crop care. And, you know, there's all these different technological aspects of life that would go down. Oh, and also the other thing about satellites is, it's not just that they get fried by the blast, which, you know, is a threat to communications and national security, which in our day does not just mean what if the missiles launch. It also means, like, is there continuity of government? You know, does a coup happen the next time this stuff goes down. But there's also actually physically more drag on satellites when they have to, when the atmosphere thickens, when these charged particles thicken the atmosphere.
Really?
They have to exercise more power to stay aloft. So it is kind of like weather.
You would think that because satellites are in a low Earth orbit, so there is some atmosphere?
That's correct. The stuff that's higher does not get affected. And so the GPS is okay. But everything lower, no wait, what's higher up? Whatever's higher is fine. The stuff that's lower suddenly has to exert more power to stay in. This is what happened to Skylab, and it's you're going to lose satellites. Other satellite, they're going to not be where you thought they were. Another satellite will be there, so you won't know what it is. The system will be misaligned for quite a while.
And a Carrington event alone, like something just that scale, would be enough to make this happen?
A Carrington event would do all this. And the problem is a Carrington event, the, what did I call it? The SWPC, the Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder, would tell us, is not the worst case scenario.
Oh.
That's just the one we remember.
Oh.
There has never been in the industrial era a coronal mass ejection from the sun in the direction of Earth. But that is...
But we see them happen.
Yeah, we know they happen. And it's estimated that every few centuries, one of these is going to happen in our direction. And that is the bad one. You know, that's the one where the power grid goes down because every transformer gets fried.
Right.
So it's not just that like some central point needs to get replaced. It's like every transformer in every county in the developed world now needs to be replaced, and nobody is going to have enough of them to replace them all. So there's supply chain issues. So it's not just like, well, this is going to take trillions of dollars. It's, you know, it's not just this is going to take a week to set up, and it's not just this is going to be expensive to fix. It's also like it might take us a decade to recover because we won't have the parts.
Wow.
And this is not like a kind of a funny what if. This is like, and we know this happens every so often. It's not if it will happen. It's like when. Some scientists think there's a 12% chance in the next decade of a Carrington event scale interruption. And how ready we are for recovery. Like, are we stockpiling a spare transformer for every power plant on Earth? And we're not.
Wow.
So this is, you know, the Carrington event is kind of a fun, quaint, cozy thing to you know, remember. Our first encounter with solar weather as a species.
Right. To do cute paintings of it is one thing, and every once in a while to shock a telegraph operator.
At some point, somebody's going to look at a gold pan on a cabin in Alaska and see the aurora and shake their fist because that was the thing that led to the coup or that killed everybody that was in a hospital that night or, you know, led to the 5-year darkness, whatever it was. The last biggies were in 1859, we know, the Carrington event, 1872, 1921. It's just a question of when.
So, I mean, this was why I bought an old truck that didn't have any computers in it.
Because you were ready.
I was ready for the, but I, you know, I thought mostly I was preparing for the electromagnetic pulse of the big one.
You thought it was going to be
And then
the Serbians or something.
I must have read something about solar flares because I was like, well, I'll survive that too. But now I don't have my old truck anymore. I just have some newfangled truck.
So you feel like your idea of this is everyone with an old truck will survive, everyone with a new truck will not.
Yeah, and there are no old trucks anymore. It's all new trucks. But like, how will a Tesla battery respond to a coronal mass ejection?
Right. Well, does it? I mean, now that pretty much even ICE cars are so digital and electrically based.
Yeah.
Does it fry every car?
I mean, does the electrical motor still work, but everything else is fried and so you can't drive it? Or, I mean, if you had solar power on your roof and a home battery, would you be able to survive it or would that be the first stuff to fry?
I mean, the thing that scares me the most about it is even if all your individual behaviors are right, there's the global effects, the knock-on effects of all of the, you know, the healthcare failing, the,
right,
you know, industry failing, every institution failing, military, whatever, means that you're just the guy with a working truck in a lawless utopia. And to you, that's the dream.
Yeah.
But that's you know, I just want to go to the mall.
Well, I know. I mean, my daughter said the other day in response to something I said about, like, we have to be ready. She was like, I don't want to be the only person.
Like, that's your dream.
I was like, well, what do you mean? I mean, you don't want to be one of the... And she was like, yeah, if everybody dies, I want to die too.
I kind of want to see numbers on that. I bet there are many U.S. states where many more people would rather... be one of the first hit than live in the lawless utopia.
Yeah, right.
It maybe just depends on how delusional you are about how livable the lawless utopia is. I don't know.
So if a coronal mass ejection happened right now, how long would it take before it hit the Earth?
We got 8 minutes, I think.
8 minutes.
And if we'd see it at the same time, you know, visible light and charged particles travel at the same speed, famously. Right. So
we'd go.
We'd have no warning.
It'd be even worse than the day after.
But that's why there is this room of people in Boulder that are just watching sunspots and stuff, because we may get some warning. I mean, it doesn't help you ramp up transformer production,
right? But wait, if you shut it down, if you shut the grid down, and then
that's a good question.
The solar wind hits us. Can you then power it back up? Is it only fry if it's on?
That's a great question. I don't want to speculate.
Yeah.
That does seem like a valuable... But, like, would anybody do it? Is there the political will to be like, there's now an 8% chance of one of these in the next week? We're going to shut down global power?
Shut it down.
It doesn't... I mean,
the thing is, my truck sits in the driveway like 9 days out of 10. So I have a good chance even my crappy modern truck might be, just because it's sitting there idle.
The fact that from Obama on, like, U.S.
Wait
administration...
Wait a minute, are you going to blame this on Obama?
Yeah, obviously.
Okay. Like, all right, good.
You think he was born in Kenya? He's born in the sun. No, because every presidential administration since the Obama era has taken this seriously, policy is getting determined by space weather now. The Army has restarted orienteering courses.
Good.
What if all you had was a compass and a map on a neckerchief?
Well, that's all I give my kid when I drop her off out in the wilderness.
The Navy has started sextant training again for the first time. Like, if you were in a PT boat, if you're in a cruiser and you didn't have GPS, what would you do?
How long do you think it would take the two of us to relearn how to use a slide rule?
I feel like that's an afternoon project for me.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody's going to be... I mean, who wants logarithms in the first week after the thing crashes? But later, when somebody's like, I want to get my windmill set up again on my farm, I'd be the guy who's like, oh, let me go get my slide rule.
I know how to do this. Yeah, it might take me a little bit longer because I never really learned trigonometry in the first place.
There's not that much trigonometry, right?
I never really learned that much...
Logarithms?
Geometry.
You don't know much about... Your science books or the French you took?
I don't. I know a little bit about the French I took. And that concludes the Carrington event, entry 189.2P0312, certificate number 54094, in the omnibus. Futurelink social media died its most inglorious death, even before the massive coronal ejection put nougat all over your pocket phone.
By the way, it seems like current can be induced in a transformer even when it's off.
Even when it's off.
So it can still overheat and burn out.
One of the great things about losing everything, about all of the GPS satellites plummeting to the Earth and our whole supply chain being fried forever, is that you'll never have to go post another picture of your elf on a shelf on your Instagram page. It'll all be over and done with, and all of that stuff will be gone unless you've been saving it like we have on platinum discs.
It's true. Your pictures are gone unless you printed them out in little Shutterfly books and gave them to your parents or grandkids or whatever.
Which you should be doing, although it's too late to do it for this most recently passed Christmas 1 week ago.
Let's see.
Oh, yeah. Happy New Year, right? It's the New Year.
It's true.
Hey, Happy New Year.
You missed Hanukkah as well, and yeah. Kwanzaa. What's the next gift-giving holiday? Mother's Day.
No, I think Valentine's Day.
Correct.
Yeah.
I was just testing you.
Oh, right on. I mean, we give President's Day presents here.
Is that right?
Yeah.
What, like a log cabin syrup, yeah, or a Kennedy dollar,
wooden
half dollar?
Teeth we give. I could use a wooden tooth.
Here's a stovepipe hat again.
But you can find us until the big catastrophe. You can find us at Omnibus Project, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. That's going to be hard to do after the big firestorm. But you can mail us actual things, and hopefully the Postal Service will still be, although they're driving electric trucks now.
They do say neither heat nor snow nor hail, but they don't say coronal mass ejection. Right?
The implication is weather. So space weather.
Space weather is a kind of weather.
But you can mail us things to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155, or 44, or 33, or 66.
Don't say 44. That's the bad one.
Don't send it to 98144.
And 66 is not great either.
And it sounds like you're opening some mail over there. What do you got? What do you got in the mailbag?
You get annoyed when I open mail during the show, but I should have done it. This was my show, so it would have been a real power move to just like
it would have been
opening mail the whole time.
If you open mail during your own show, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, like nobody cares about your shows.
No, I think it would be a superpower.
Let's see. This is from, the card is a tartan. It's like a plaid.
It's going to be about our tartan show.
Jennifer came to a book signing of mine last year in L.A. Oh, she was the one who did the Baby Yoda, the crocheted the Baby Yoda and the Lego minifigure head with the toilet paper.
Super cool.
Do you have? I still have both. Were there two of these? Or did I take all her crochet work?
I have a Lego one. We never got a Baby Yoda one.
I have a Baby Yoda. Woo! And I guess her mom, Jennifer's mom, is jealous that I have her crochet work when her mom is apparently quite crafty as well. So she sent me a wall hanging. I hope it finds pride of place in your home. Ooh, pressure. This is kind of beautiful.
Was this done by her mother?
Yes. It's like an embroidered Seattle skyline.
Oh my gosh, that is really beautiful.
It's really nice. It's a little bit fanciful because of the big pine forest she has beginning in south downtown Seattle.
Well, I like the lighthouse too, which must be on Vashon.
It could be an Alki, I guess, right?
Alki's not connected to.
Right.
Oh, I see.
Maybe West Seattle is curving up here below. There's a ferry boat.
Look at the back because it's really beautiful on the back.
The back is like an aurora borealis. It's too nice to hang because you would miss half of the stuff.
Well, you could hang it like in the hall.
I could fly it like a flag.
Yeah, that's gorgeous. Congratulations.
And it's like, I don't know, this is some kind of embroidery, so it kind of feels like a pot holder, which is like an oven mitt.
Don't use it as a pot holder.
It's too big.
You could use it as a runner on your dining room table.
This thing is like 3 feet long. I don't make food long enough for this to be a pot holder.
I bet Mindy will find something. I like the ferry boat. There's Orca in there.
This is really great. Thank you to Jennifer's mom, whose name is apparently Florence.
Thanks, Florence.
Oh, and also P.S. Hi, John.
Yeah, well, you know.
I got this.
That's all I can expect,
you got
really.
Six letters. Jennifer, please thank your mom for us if she doesn't listen to this show. Angus in Portland hopefully included a note. Yes. A very empowering activist postcard with people of all colors and hues and creeds and abilities and sexualities working together.
Working together to do what? Build a Marxist utopia?
I think so. They got a megaphone. That's the main thing you need.
That's what you do.
Angus is a fan of the Omnibus. He's been listening to old episodes, and we did one about election ties, like tied elections 4 years ago.
Yep.
We didn't do that this year for some reason. He works for an Oregon-based organization that works to make democracy accessible for all. And they
one of the key elements of democracy.
It's kind of in the name.
Yeah.
But to make it understandable to kids, I guess his organization produced these kids' books called A Kid's Book About Voting, which is all about why it's so important to vote, who gets to vote, why you're... can't complain if you don't vote. This is great. I guess my kid, you know, both of my kids, one of my kids voted, my other kid is a week away from being old enough to vote.
Oh, wow. Will be a week away on election day.
Yeah, election day, like his birthday is then like 8 days later.
You know, we are recording this. This may be, well, it's one of the last shows we will record before the election. So we are still in the dark. You, listening to this show, already know at least who was nominally elected president, although hard to say who will be inaugurated.
A lot of you had a lot of crypto in those betting markets on Trump. Some of you have done very well. Some of you didn't. We don't know.
But, you know, my kid is in her social studies class is covering all of the initiative and referenda.
That's good.
In Washington state.
Staying away from the presidential race. Yeah. That's pretty smart.
So she comes home all the time and she's like, oh my God, these terrible initiatives. And I'm like, you don't know the half of it. I love talking about Washington state initiatives. And it's just one more thing she hates about me.
At least this year, there's no vanity Tim Iman ones. Like this year, they're actually kind of substantive.
Yeah, although there's the...
They're awful, but...
There's the, roll back the carbon offsets one.
Yes.
That's like a billionaire...
They're all oil and gas funded.
Yeah.
But at least it's, for some reason, I prefer that to just like...
A guy who's like, we're paying too much taxes.
Yeah, just rich Bellevue car dealership owners and dentists complaining about car tabs.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, at least we're not California, as I say every morning when I wake up.
That's my daily affirmation.
And futurelings, believe you me, it's a new year, 2025, and as a resolution, I can't think of a better one you could make than to resolve to support your favorite podcast, the Omnibus Podcast. And if we are your second favorite podcast after some other, I don't know what, NPR one, or maybe sports. You like sports a lot.
Mark Maron.
No, nobody's going to prefer Mark Maron to us.
Joe Rogan.
Maybe, no. Well, maybe one of those where they talk about a murder. Maybe you like those.
Yeah. We're your favorite podcast where nobody dies.
But
even the guy that got shocked by his telegraph receiver,
yeah,
he lived. He's fine.
Yeah. In your version of the story, we lose all of our transformers, but we all survive. It's like a neutron bomb, except the opposite of a neutron bomb. It destroys all the cities, but leaves all the people alive. What a terrible bomb. I would suggest to you as part of your 2025 resolutions to go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and pledge just a little money, just a little pittance, just a little walking around money, but you're essentially one latte a week.
Couch money, couch cushion money.
To the Omnibus Project. It helps keep the show on the air, and there's lots and lots and lots of benefits to accrue from your donation.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long it was until the next coronal mass ejection event. Is that the sound it would make?
No. In space, no one can hear you scream, and no one hears a coronal mass event.
Every transformer hears it at once. Bzz. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. I mean, John doesn't even have the right truck for it anymore.
I know.
You still have the clothes for it.
Clothes?
Clothes.
Oh, I do have the clothes.
You probably have a hatchet.
Yep, I do.
If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.